listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Guns are a part of American life. Of that, I'm sure we are all in agreement. Each time a high-profile horror like Columbine or Oklahoma City or the recent shooting of Representative Giffords and others in Arizona happens, the debate rages on. In his skillful historical narrative, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, Adam Winkler takes on the contentious issue of gun control in the United States. He weaves together the stories of gun rights advocates and gun control lobbyists, providing insight into the debate that divides our nation. He touches on every imaginable source for the modern debate on gun control, founding era understandings, gun control laws in the 19th and 20th centuries, attitude towards guns in Britain after the Glorious Revolution, the role of guns in the civil rights movement, and empirical research on the effects of gun control. Adam Winkler is a specialist in American constitutional law. His wide-ranging scholarship has touched upon a diverse array of topics, such as the right to bear arms, corporate political speech rights, affirmative action, among many others. His work has been cited and quoted in landmark Supreme Court cases, including opinions dealing with the Second Amendment and with corporate political speech rights. Adam is a Los Angeles native, I'm proud to report. He earned his law degree at New York University in 1993 and then moved back to LA to practice law with noted criminal defense lawyer Howard Weitzman. And I love this. On the UCLA website, it notes, in Adam's first case out of law school, he worked with Weitzman representing the late Michael Jackson in a highly publicized child molestation case. He was also part of the defense team that initially represented O.J. Simpson in the football player's infamous murder trial. This was more than enough to convince Adam to return to academia. He is now on the faculty of the UCLA School of Law, where he teaches constitutional law, professional responsibility, constitutional theory, gun control, and firearms policy. And we are so lucky to have in conversation with Adam tonight, Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the founding dean of the University of California Irvine Law School. Erwin is a graduate of Northwestern and Harvard Law School. He's authored 7 books and nearly 200 law review articles. He was most recently here at Aloud to discuss the conservative assault on the Constitution, his latest book. He's argued several cases before the Supreme Court and various circuits of the United States Courts of Appeals. And among his many, many contributions to our community were his 2 years serving as chair of the elected Los Angeles Charter Reform Commission. And it's an honor to have both of these distinguished jurors with us tonight. Now, please join me in welcoming Adam Winkler and Erwin Chemerinsky to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. It's such an honor and a pleasure to be here. Adam has written a magnificent book titled Gunfight. No matter how much you think you know about the Second Amendment, you will learn a tremendous amount more by reading the book, and it is just beautifully written, accessible to a wide audience. So let me start, Adam, by giving you the chance to explain to the audience the thesis of the book.
Well, thank you, Erwin, and thanks to you all for coming here to the library for having us. It's a real honor to be here. Especially in conversation with Erwin, who we've worked on a Supreme Court brief before, and so it's a special honor for me. So the book Gunfight argues that the problem with the gun debate is that we've been captured by the extremes on both sides of this issue, whether we're talking about gun rights hardliners who oppose nearly any kind of gun control law as an infringement on the Second Amendment, but also gun control advocates who deny the existence of one of our oldest, most established constitutional rights, and in their desire to get rid of America's guns are willing to support silly and ineffective laws that actually don't reduce crime. And I think that the key to moving forward in the gun debate is to break away from these extremes. I think that we often think of gun control as a modern invention, But one of the things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that while the right to bear arms is a well-established right in American law, we've always had gun control. And one of the things I tried to do in Gunfight is to show how we've tried to balance these things, gun rights and gun control, through the course of American history, and how that effort to make that balance has shaped America in really fascinating and surprising ways.
At this point in American history, conservatives consistently take the gun rights position, liberals consistently take the gun control position. When did that happen, and why did it happen that way?
And it certainly hasn't always been that way. In fact, I tell a remarkable story in the book about the day the Black Panthers, of all people, launched the modern gun rights movement. It was a day in May of 1967, and it was a remarkable spectacle. 30 Black Panthers showed up at the California State Capitol with loaded rifles, shotguns, and pistols. And they walked right up the staircase past a group of visiting eighth grade school children who were there on a school field trip. They weren't expecting to see that. And they walked right up into the California State Capitol building and right inside the most important building of the state. There was no metal detectors, security didn't stop them, and in fact, they hadn't done anything illegal. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law. The law was being proposed to disarm the Black Panthers, to make it unlawful to carry loaded weapons in public in the state of California. Ironically, the proposed gun control law was supported by conservative Republicans, including the state's governor at the time, former actor by the name of Ronald Reagan. And indeed, it was conservative Republicans, and not just conservative, they lined up, there were plenty of Democrats as well, that were supporting gun control laws in the early 1960s. Those laws remarkably caused a backlash, and it was a backlash that led to the rise of the modern gun rights movement, ironically one that is white, rural, and politically conservative.
But my question is still, why did it become that way? We tend to think of conservatives being more pro-law and order, more pro-law enforcement. We tend to think of liberals as being more pro-individual rights. So I could have easily seen it develop that conservatives would take the gun control position as a way of furthering law and order, and liberals would take the gun rights position in the same way they take, say, a more pro-free speech position. Why did it not turn out that way?
Well, I think in part because gun control, the move to really take away Americans' guns really began in the late 1960s, and it was, I think, part of the Great Society programs, the idea that there was a lot of faith in government, you didn't need individuals having their own guns, that we could take these guns away and leave protection to government. But there, as part of the rise of the new right in the early 1970s, there was a lot of conservatives who were opposed to this idea, thought that the government was getting too big, the government was not the answer to our problems. Also corresponded with a time of very starkly rising crime rates that left a lot of people feeling that not only were they insecure on the streets, but that the government couldn't be trusted to protect them because the government wasn't protecting them. Remember, in 1967, we had the worst race riots in American history. Newark and Detroit were practically destroyed because of race riots in the streets. So I just think that there was a lot of conservatives that became associated with the new right. But I think you see it today in the Tea Party movement, where the argument is that government has gotten too big and that we can't trust government. Yeah, that sort of really corresponds with the rise of the new gun rights movement in the 1970s.
Much of the book tells the story of a case that was before the Supreme Court in 2008, District of Columbia versus Heller. The book tells that story, that case, from the beginning through the end, and really weaves all of the rest around that narrative. And ultimately, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, declares unconstitutional a D.C. ordinance that makes it a crime to own or possess a handgun and imposes restrictions on long guns. Now, if I asked you, how did the Supreme Court divide if it was 5-4? You can easily guess. Scalia writes for the court, joined by Roberts, Kennedy, Thomas, Alito, and Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer dissent. That's what we would all have guessed. You tell a long story in the book about all of the litigation strategy in the case, the various maneuvers that are made about who was going to argue the case and the like. Did any of that really matter? Given the ideological split you just described, Was it always a foreordained conclusion with these nine justices, this was going to come out 5-4 this way?
Well, it may have been. There's no doubt that there was certainly a core on the Supreme Court that was going to vote in favor of gun rights here. Now, something that both Irwin and I know is in all our studies of the Constitution, it doesn't really matter that much what the framers of the Constitution intended. In terms of just being descriptive here about how the Supreme Court reacts. The Supreme Court reacts to social movements. And in the same way that there was a social movement for civil rights that led to the Supreme Court's strong rulings in that area, a social movement for women's equality that led the Supreme Court to create legal rules protecting women. And today we're seeing a social movement for gay rights, and the Supreme Court is responding, even though a conservative Supreme Court is responding in a positive way to that for the most part. The same thing happened in the area of gun rights. We had a social movement in this country over the last 40 years, very much strongly in favor of individual ownership of firearms, and I think that had a big influence on the Supreme Court. One of the stories I tell in the book, Irwin's absolutely right, it revolves around this Heller litigation, in this case, District of Columbia against Heller. And before the case, the big question was, well, how are these justices going to rule? We don't really know, whether the conservatives will stay conservative on this issue. They had never ruled on a Second Amendment issue. And the big question was Justice Kennedy, the swing vote. How is he going to vote? And I remember sitting at oral argument. I was there actually with my mother at oral argument. And we were watching it, and we were all paying. I said, you want to pay attention. What does Justice Kennedy say? Because he's the swing vote. And not 2 minutes into the oral argument, Justice Kennedy announces, well, I believe the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms. And it was like, oh, all this drama about who's counting, which justices are going to go where, case closed, this game was just won right there 2 minutes into the case.
The Second Amendment, of course, says a well-regulated militia, being necessary for state, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The conservatives want to focus just on the second half. I think you point out in the book that the NRA headquarters has just the second half on its building, whereas liberals want to focus on the first half and say, this is about a well-regulated militia. That's about what there's a right to have guns for. Does this just show, then, that constitutional interpretation is about the conclusion you want to come to?
Well, it may be, and there's no doubt. I think it's really more a response to serious social movements that are trying to find meaning and trying to find direction in their lives, and they seek out answers in the Constitution. You know, it's pretty clear that the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, that's the basis for Brown versus Board of Education and all the rulings providing for equal rights for racial minorities, it's pretty clear that the framers of the 14th Amendment did not intend that provision to protect, to outlaw segregated schools. We had segregated schools when that amendment was added, and even the most liberal state in the Union at the time, Massachusetts, had racially segregated schools. So we're always seeking to find meaning in the Constitution, to shape our lives and project it onto the Constitution and pull it out. I don't think the language is totally irrelevant. I don't think that we would have read a right to keep and bear arms into the Fourth Amendment's right against unreasonable searches and seizures, but you never know. I think that for all the debate about the Second Amendment, whether it's about militias or whether it's about an individual right to bear arms, one basic idea seems pretty incontestable, which is that the framers thought that that amendment would prevent the federal government from taking away all of the civilian guns, whether it was for a militia or for individual use.
But should that matter? As you just said, the same Congress that voted to ratify the 14th Amendment voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. We, therefore, aren't obligated to allow segregation in the modern world. Should it matter what the framers meant with regard to the Second Amendment? And are we really left to just choose between these two views? The liberal view, the individual rights view, the gun control view, and the conservative view, the individual rights view of the Second Amendment?
Well, to address the second part first, I don't think we're relegated to choosing one extreme or the other. And in fact, I think the real idea behind the whole book is that we can have a right to bear arms and have gun control, that they're not mutually exclusive ideas, that they've actually lived together since the birth of America, that we've always had both these things, a right to bear arms and gun control. And with regards to the Second Amendment, I mean, one of the things I emphasize in the book is that perhaps in thinking about the gun debate, we think too much about the Second Amendment and the Founding Fathers. Every state has its own constitution, and virtually all the states, not quite all, but about 86% of the states have provisions in their own constitutions providing for an individual right to have arms that is clearly unrelated to any kind of militia service. So there's a long tradition there. And also I talk about the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. That's the one with the Equal Protection Clause, adopted right after the Civil War, was designed in part to protect the freedmen's constitutional rights, including the framers of that amendment said over and over again, the right to have a gun for personal protection.
Let me push a little bit on this idea that there can be a middle ground, which is so much the thesis of the book. As I've said, as you've said, when the Supreme Court considers the issue, five justices focus on the second half of the Second Amendment, that the right to keep arms shall not be infringed. Four justices focus on the first half, saying that it's really all about a well-regulated militia. What's the middle ground between those two positions?
I think the middle ground is to recognize a basic right to have a firearm for personal protection, at the same time recognizing that there's ample room for gun control, that we can still do things like have background checks, we can still do things like outlaw machine guns, we can still do the things that can help us provide a more safe environment for our families and for our communities. And that's the middle position in the sense that one side, the gun control side, has for the last 30 or 40 years, sought to get rid of guns, to eliminate civilian ownership of certainly handguns, and has hoped for to end civilian ownership of guns more generally. And the gun rights side has taken the position that almost any gun control law violates the Second Amendment's language, shall not be infringed. So the middle ground is to say we take the extremes of both sides off the table.
But haven't you then come down with the conservatives in the individual rights position? That you're basically saying to me, if you were on the Supreme Court in 2008, you would have voted with Scalia and Roberts and Kennedy and Thomas and Alito and said that the Second Amendment does give individuals a right to bear arms.
Irwin, after this, I challenge you to a duel. You have insulted my honor, sir. I do believe that the best interpretation of our constitutional traditions is that there is an individual right to own a firearm. And it's not just the Second Amendment. It's, as I said, state constitutional law. I think it's part of the purpose of the 14th Amendment. That was part of the design of the 14th Amendment, was to do that too. But I'm not on their side. And believe me, I've dealt with a lot of the gun rights people these days, especially in preparation for the book and in publication of the book. And they disagree with me on almost any gun control law you can imagine that I might support and that they oppose. So, I always say we need to get beyond the idea that we can get rid of the guns in America. There's 280 million guns in the United States. That's more than one per adult, almost one per person. They're not going anywhere. We tried to outlaw alcohol with prohibition. It was not successful. We tried to outlaw drugs with the war on drugs. I'll leave it to you to determine whether you think that's been successful. My view is that it hasn't. So if we try to ban easy to conceal things that people feel very passionately about, I think we're destined for failure.
One of the points you make in the book, though, is that any regulatory scheme will also, to some extent, fail. Even if we have registration, people will get guns without registering them. Even if we have background checks, people will buy guns at gun shows and avoid the background checks, and so on. And you make the point very powerfully, the fact that laws might be violated isn't a reason to not have laws. Murder laws are violated, and people sometimes get away with murder, but we still have murder laws. So if gun laws could decrease the number of guns and decrease the amount of crime, then why not allow the government to ban it, even if prohibition isn't going to be completely successful?
Well, if we were... Well, first of all, I think there's a couple of reasons. One, I don't think it would be effective. Number two, I think actually we have a constitutional tradition that we should respect. And if we want to overturn that constitutional tradition, we should come together as a social movement, fight against that, and overturn that that vision of the Constitution. I think the American people are really very firmly going the other direction and firm it. But you're absolutely right. I don't believe the gun rights advocates' argument, which is that, well, we can't have any gun control laws because they will never work. The purpose of the law is not just to stop people from doing something you don't want them to do. You hope that it's going to create enough disincentive and stop them from doing it. But we have rape laws. It doesn't stop rapists. We have murder laws, as you say, they don't stop murderers. What we do is we punish certain kinds of behavior because we think it's socially dangerous or socially destructive. And that's why we should still have good gun control laws, even if they might not be obeyed.
What you've said tonight, and you certainly express in the book, is that there's a constitutional tradition in favor of gun rights. What's striking is, as you know, from 1791, when the Second Amendment was adopted, until 2008, when District of Columbia versus Heller is decided, no Supreme Court case ever adopts the individual rights view with regard to guns. In light of that, is there really such a constitutional tradition for your position on the Second Amendment?
I think there is, and part of the reason why there was no such case is because the Supreme Court had not ruled directly on the meaning of the Second Amendment. There was one case back in the 1930s, United States against Miller, but anyone, if you go back and read this case, it's remarkable for its ambiguity. It doesn't address the question directly. But there are cases throughout history where the court has mentioned the Second Amendment and referred to the individual right to bear arms. I never like to cite in support of my position the infamous case of Dred Scott. But one of the reasons why Chief Justice Roger Taney argued that blacks could not be citizens was because he said, well, then they'd be entitled to the full range of constitutional rights, including the First Amendment, the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and he said the right to keep and carry a gun anywhere they went. So it's not like this is a brand new interpretation of the Second Amendment. It's been hotly contested for many, many years. But it's not, I don't think the idea that the Second Amendment protects an individual right is somehow a newly arising view of the Second Amendment. It certainly was not as strong in the founding era as it was today, as it is today. But I think ever since about the 1820s, really, the Second Amendment has been reinterpreted to protect an individual right by a lot of people and a lot of legal sources.
The story you tell, certainly key part of it is the National Rifle Association. In fact, we would all say that a key part of the story of guns in the United States is the National Rifle Association. One of the things I found particularly interesting in the book is that the NRA didn't always take an extreme gun rights position. In fact, for much of its history, even favored certain forms of gun regulation. What changed, and when did it change?
Yeah, we really think of the NRA today as this no-compromises opponent of gun control, but it really wasn't always this way. The NRA was started right after the Civil War by two men, one of whom, by the way, was a reporter for a newspaper that's not really associated with gun rights these days. He was a reporter for the New York Times. And it was designed basically to enhance marksmanship training. They fought for the Union side in the Civil War, and they were embarrassed by what they thought was the poor marksmanship of Union soldiers. And they suspected that part of the reason why the war lasted so long was because the Southern soldiers were really good at shooting. And the Northern soldiers were really bad at shooting. And so they wanted to enhance marksmanship training. They weren't born to fight for the Second Amendment. And in fact, in the 1920s and 30s, the NRA drafted and helped promote in state after state after state restrictive gun control laws on carrying concealed weapons. Laws that today the NRA fights to overturn. And in fact, in 1934, when the president of the NRA was asked to testify in Congress about the first major federal gun control law. It was the National Firearms Act of 1934. It banned, didn't quite ban, but heavily restricted machine guns and various kinds of gangster weapons. He was asked to testify, and he was asked during his testimony, does the Second Amendment impose any limits on this federal law? And his answer was remarkable from the perspective of today. He said, quote, "I have not given it any study from that point of view." So the president of the NRA had never thought about whether the Second Amendment had any impact on this, on the most far-reaching federal gun control law today. And all that changed, really, in the 1970s when the Second Amendment became the lifeblood of the NRA.
And why did it change?
And what? Well, the NRA had a coup. The NRA in the 1970s, there was a real divide in the membership. After some of the gun control laws of the 1960s that we talked about that were supported actually by conservatives, some members of the NRA were really opposed to those gun control laws, but the leadership of the NRA was generally in favor of them. And so the leadership decided they were going to retreat from political activity, relocate to the West, and focus the NRA on marksmanship training, outdoors activities, hunting, recreational shooting. And a group of hardliners staged a coup d'etat in the annual membership meeting in 1977 and ousted the entire leadership, replaced them with this new hardline leadership. And this new hardline leadership was really motivated by the idea that guns were not about hunting and recreation. They were about self-defense against criminals. And it was that new version of the NRA that really became the political powerhouse that we know today.
And as you point out in the book, a core aspect of the NRA is, say, any form of gun regulation is opening a door that has to be kept shut. And it seems that's been a very effective rhetorical and political strategy, that even if occasionally they lose some fights and there's some laws, they may be very successful in keeping there from being more extensive regulation by this absolutist position.
And one of the main problems that comes from that is that the NRA insists on watering down laws that are proposed, gun control laws that are proposed, and then shockingly, the gun control law doesn't work very well because it's riddled with loopholes, and then the NRA and the gun lobby points to the gun law and says, well, see, we told you gun control doesn't work. That's what we have today. We have background checks on gun purchases. However, the NRA insisted on a loophole in the law that said only federally licensed gun dealers have to conduct a background check. If you're not regularly in the business of selling guns, you just do it as a hobby or on the side, then you don't have to get a license. And if you don't have a license, you don't have to do a background check. So right now we have background checks for guns, gun purchases under federal law, except when you don't. And you have 40% of lawful gun sales, perfectly above the law, you know, above the table, lawful purchases that are done without background checks. And the gun lobby says, well, see, gun control doesn't work. But of course it doesn't work. We've created this huge loophole that's going to prevent it from working. So the absolutist position is a very successful rhetorical position. The position I take in the book, which is sort of a very more balanced, we can have a little bit of both, is clearly not going to win any elections.
Well, I want to spend a good deal of time talking about that middle position because it is so much central to your thesis of the book. Earlier when I said, why not ban guns, you said, banning guns just won't be successful in reducing crime. Are there alternatives that really can be successful, given the huge number of guns there are in the United States that you write about and that you spoke of? Can background checks, can registration really have any effect in decreasing crime with guns?
I think they can have an effect, but we do have to be realistic about the effect. There is no single law out there that is going to solve all of our gun problems. Look, the gun problem itself is complicated. We think that, okay, we're going to try to keep criminals from having guns. But you know, the majority of gun deaths in America aren't criminals. They're suicide. That's right. More than 50% of the gun deaths every year are suicides. I don't know what gun control law is really going to stop someone from trying to commit suicide. And certainly if you got rid of all the guns, somehow you could snap your fingers, get rid of all the guns, some of those people would not be able to commit suicide as easily, but they'd probably still, you know, they'd probably still hurt themselves. So I think the real key is not to focus on individual proposals and try to figure out whether they are going to work or not in the short term. We have to change the dynamic of the gun debate, and it's only when we change that dynamic, get everyone on board with the idea that, or at least get enough people on board with the idea that there is a basic right, but yet we can still have gun control law and it's not going to put us on a slippery slope. It's only when we change that dynamic that we can move forward and start addressing, well, how about would this little piece help a little bit? And would this little piece help a little bit more?
How do you change that dynamic? I think the NRA types are going to disagree with you and say that the Second Amendment is an absolute. And you certainly refer to many groups in the book that take an absolute gun rights position. And liberals are going to continue to say, no, you're wrong. There is no individual right in the Second Amendment. It's just about a right to have guns from militias. How do you find the middle ground between those positions?
Well, I think we can find the middle ground. And I think actually one of the keys to finding the middle ground is the District of Columbia against Heller case that is the centerpiece of the book. I think that by establishing a firm protection for the basic right to bear arms, I think there's a lot of gun owners who are going to say, well, if my basic right is protected and I can still get a firearm when I need to, no one's coming to take my guns, I can support some other kinds of gun control laws because I'm not worried about the slippery slope towards total gun confiscation. So I do think that it is possible. I tell the story also in the book. There's a famous picture that was taken the day the Little Rock Nine tried to integrate Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas. This was the first major public high school to try integration after Brown versus Board of Education. And it's a very famous photograph. Many of you have probably seen it. It shows an African-American girl named Elizabeth Eckford in a white dress, and she's carrying a book, clutching it to her chest, and she's surrounded by the most angry mob you can ever imagine. And there, you can see in the photographs the hatred and anger on the face of these white racists who do not want these black people in their schools. If we stood on the corner that day And I said to you, you know, I think we can move beyond the extreme polarization of the racial integration question in America. You'd have thought I was completely nuts. And you would have been right, probably. But we did. We've moved very far. Not to say that we've eliminated our race problems, far from it. But we have moved beyond the extreme positions that once defined American race relationships, including the position that African Americans who had to be second-class citizens and segregated. Part of the reason why that happened, I think, was social change that was helped along by Supreme Court rulings that provided some basic protection for the underlying rights. I'm hopeful, I'm not necessarily certain it's going to happen, but I'm hopeful that maybe the gun cases might help us move in that direction.
What would you say to the NRA person who believes that you're not giving enough protection for gun rights, or to the liberal who says, you're giving far too much in the way of gun rights? Why should they agree with you? Why should they believe finding this middle is better?
Well, I'm not sure that they'll believe me in the short run, but I think in the long run, having basic legal protections will help convince them that we can have one, or we can have a little bit of both. We can have a little bit of the right to bear arms and a little bit of gun control. You know, it's been surprising in writing the book. I viewed the book when I was writing it as in some ways the future of the gun control movement. The book was inspired in part because I would get a lot of calls from reporters after the District of Columbia against Heller case was decided, and the reporters would ask me, what does this mean for the future of gun control? The NRA people are telling us that we're now going to start striking down the 20,000 gun control laws in America. And I thought that that was just not right. That was not an accurate assessment of what or not an accurate prediction of what the future would bring. I think that the court made plenty of room for gun control laws in the opinion, and indeed there's been hundreds of cases since the Heller case decided challenging gun control laws in the wake of Heller. As you know, Erwin, that the vast majority of those gun control laws have been upheld. So I thought of it as sort of a way forward in the gun control movement. I've been surprised to find a welcome reception among many people in the gun rights field, too. I think there's a lot of people in the gun rights field who actually feel that if the basic right to bear arms is going to be protected, then they've won the issue that they were most concerned about. They really are convinced the government was trying to come get their guns. If we can convince them the government's not coming to get their guns, I think it'll be a major step forward for America.
Can you be more specific about what kinds of gun laws you think should be allowed and what kind of gun laws you think shouldn't be allowed in light of your middle ground position on the Second Amendment?
Sure. I think some of the basic things that I think we should focus on is sort of who, what, and where. Who should be able to purchase firearms? We should keep people with criminal records from having firearms, especially violent felons from being able to buy firearms, and do everything we can to keep them from getting firearms. That's what background checks are good for. Are they perfect? Do they work all the time? Obviously not. Criminals have a lot of sources to get guns, but that's one of the things we can do to make it more difficult for them to get guns. It's what? What kind of guns should they be able to get? Perfectly acceptable to outlaw firearms like machine guns that have no reasonable use for personal self-defense. And indeed, you cannot sell a brand new machine gun in America today. There's already laws on the books against that. And then there's the where. There are certain places where guns don't belong. I tell the story in the book. I open the book with the story of the Supreme Court oral argument and the lawyers going into court, and they have to, although they're going to talk about gun rights and the ability to have a gun for self-defense wherever you need it, they go into court and they have to pass through a metal detector. No guns allowed in the Supreme Court, because there, guns are not about self-defense. They're a threat to public safety, a threat to democracy. So it's really a who, what, and where question. It's not about getting rid of all the guns, but rather focusing on the kinds of things that we might be able to do to keep the wrong people from getting the wrong weapons and taking them into the wrong places.
Let me focus on the wrong places. As you know, one of the issues that's coming up is, what about laws that keep people from having guns on college campuses? Or what about laws that keep people from having guns in public parks? How would you come out on those, and how do you think the Supreme Court's going to come out, maybe even as soon as this year?
Right. I think that if the Supreme Court gets them, I would predict that the Supreme Court will uphold those restrictions. My view about guns on campus, I take what I think of as a complicated or nuanced view about this. We call UCLA, we call it a gun-free campus. You're not allowed to have a gun on campus at UCLA. But it's really not a gun-free zone, Right? No, nothing stops someone from bringing a gun onto campus. We don't. It's not like going into an airplane where you have security that you go through. I got 50,000 people coming on campus with a closed backpack. If someone wants to have a gun, they will have a gun on campus. There's nothing stopping them. So it's not really a gun-free zone. I don't think if we allowed those people to, if we said, okay, you can have guns on campus. We've tried this in a few states. There's been no increase in homicides or violence because of people having guns on campus. I think there's a possibility that there will be more accidents in dormitories and things like that from alcohol-induced accidents and whatnot. But I don't think that we're likely to have a huge impact if we liberalize those laws on gun violence. And similarly, if we keep the bans in place, it's not going to have a huge impact. It's not going to lead to what some of the gun rights people think, which is that now all of a sudden anyone who wants to kill someone is going to show up on a campus because there's where you have your guaranteed unarmed victims. So I think that keeping guns off campus is probably a good idea, but we should recognize that it's not going to be a particularly foolproof way of keeping people safe from gun violence.
Who should make these decisions? Let's take the example of campus that we're just talking about. Should we leave it to the campus or should we leave it to the courts? That's really the issue. Conservatives have so long said that courts should defer to the political process. Right. And yet here it's the conservatives saying don't defer to the political process. Court, strike down the gun laws. I'll go back to my campus example. Should we leave it to each campus to decide for itself? Or should we say the court should resolve this as a matter of the Second Amendment? And if the latter, then what should courts do on the issue?
I don't have a big problem with the courts getting involved. I mean, maybe that's the liberal in me. I don't mind if courts get involved, especially if they're going to get involved to protect rights. And I will take issue with the premise of the idea, well, the conservatives don't want the courts to step in and protect rights. I think that's really not the case. That's an old version of conservatism, which was all about judicial restraint. But today's modern conservatism is about aggressively protecting individual rights through the judicial branch where you're protecting the rights they favor. And that's really what the game is about between liberals and conservatives. I don't think it's really about some people who want judicial review and some people who don't. It's about we all want to protect the courts to step in and protect the rights that we are most concerned with. So I don't think it really matters, I guess, at the end of the day, whether courts are making the decision about whether guns could be allowed on campus or individual campuses. I think anyone who's making the decision about gun policy should be informed of the facts, should have good evidence, and not be making decisions on an emotional love of guns or an emotional hatred of guns. I will say that one of the advantages of bringing these cases into courts, I think, is that the courts are very well equipped, I think, to make reasoned, rational judgments on the basis of evidence rather than on the basis of political pressure, which is what we see currently where the courts are not involved.
To put this into the language of constitutional law for a moment, that courts don't treat all rights the same. For some claims of rights, courts are very deferential to the legislature and uphold what the legislature wants so long as it's reasonable and rational. So when the government wants to set a minimum wage and people say, I should have a right to work for less, the courts will say, so long as the legislature's reasonable, that's okay. On the other hand, for fundamental rights, the court's going to say, no, the government can interfere only if there's a compelling reason and no other way to achieve it. Where should and where will the Supreme Court treat the Second Amendment there? Because ultimately, that's going to determine how much gun regulation can be allowed or not allowed.
So there's an inside baseball story going on with this question that I just want to address, which is that Irwin and I wrote a brief together in the Heller case, and our whole argument in the brief, we didn't address whether there's a right to bear arms in the Second Amendment, but the whole basis of the brief was to answer this question. What standard of review should courts apply? Should they be deferential to legislatures or very skeptical of what legislatures do? And our brief argued that the Supreme Court should do what these state courts have been doing for almost 200 years. Remember I mentioned there was all these states that have in their own constitutions protections for the right to bear arms? Well, those have been in place, some of those have been in place since the founding, many since the early 1800s, and there have literally been hundreds and hundreds of state constitutional law cases challenging gun control laws. This is not a new area of the law, even in constitutional law. And of those hundreds of cases, you go back and it's a very clear pattern. For over 150 years, the courts have taken a very deferential approach to legislatures. That so long as you're not completely eliminating people's right to have a gun for self-defense, the courts will uphold that policy. So I generally believe that the courts will be deferential, and what we've seen so far in the light of Heller is relatively deferential review. But some review, I think courts should step in and question whether a law is likely to be effective or not. So it's not being deferential doesn't mean throwing up your hands and letting legislatures do whatever they want. But it is giving them wide leeway to make the kinds of empirical judgments about public safety that are really required.
In Heller, Justice Breyer writes a dissenting opinion in which he says, we should allow gun regulations so long as they're reasonable, the position that you would urge, that we had urged. And he says, the District of Columbia law is reasonable. There's at least some studies that show that it has decreased gun crimes. When we're using reasonableness review, we should defer to legislatures in the political process. What was wrong with that?
Well, actually, I don't believe at the end of the day that the D.C. law was reasonable in this sense. The D.C. law was effectively a complete ban on the use of a firearm for self-defense. So if there is a core right to have a gun for self-defense, the D.C. law got rid of it. A lot of people thought that the D.C. law was basically a handgun ban. And if you read the newspapers around this story, they talked a lot about handgun bans. And that's true, it did ban handguns. But it also said that if you own a long gun, a shotgun or a rifle, you had to keep it disassembled, and you could only reassemble it for recreational purposes. There had even been a court case in the District of Columbia that specifically held that if you kill someone who's breaking into your house to attack you, that is not a recreational purpose. So basically, you had no right to use a gun for self-defense, right? That was not recreational. Recreational is hunting. Recreational is target shooting. So actually, and in D.C., by the way, you couldn't even do that. There was not a single range at which you could use a long gun in the District of Columbia, and there's no hunting grounds in the District of Columbia. There's probably some wild animals in Rock Creek Park, but there is no hunting ground. So you basically could never use a firearm for self-defense in the District of Columbia. So I don't have a problem with the Supreme Court striking down that particular law.
Are there other laws that you would strike down?
I think if there's an area of law where it's problematic, and I think that the Supreme Court will find it problematic, are laws that give nearly unfettered discretion to local government officials over whether you can have a firearm in public. So in most states, you need a permit to carry a concealed weapon. And in most states, if you're not a criminal and you meet all the basic requirements, you go through the 1 hour of training or whatever is required in the particular state, you can get your permit. In places like Los Angeles, however, and San Francisco, New York, Washington, D.C., the government official has broad discretion over whether to grant this right or not. I think the Supreme Court's going to be very skeptical of laws that give that kind of discretion. I'll tell you one incident I talk in the book. You know, we've talked a lot about gun policy. The book is really much more about the fascinating hidden history of guns than it is about current policy things, although obviously there's definitely that tie as well. And one of the stories I tell is the story of the day that Martin Luther King Jr. applied for a concealed carry permit. You know, we think of him as, you know, peaceful nonviolence, but Martin Luther King, after his house was firebombed in the mid-1950s, thought, you know what, I need to protect myself. There are white racists out here trying to kill me every single day. He was right, of course. And so he applied for a permit in Alabama, and the local police chief, despite the fact that Martin Luther King was receiving individual threats to his life on a daily basis, said he didn't have sufficiently good reason to receive a firearms permit and denied the permit. Laws that provide unfettered discretion for government officials to give or deny privileges or rights have historically been used for bad purposes and against the oppressed classes and the racial minorities. So, and that's part of, as I talk about in the book, the complicated relationship between race and guns in America.
And yet you began this evening by saying that gun rights advocates tend to be rural and white. Minorities who often would need protection in some unsafe neighborhoods tend not to be gun rights advocates. Why is that?
Well, I think the rural-urban thing is kind of complicated, too, in the story of guns. We think of it as about, well, you can't take a gun away from someone who received this gun when they were on their hunting trip with their father at the age of 9. You know, and it's like it has this association with this, these cultural values and these family values. And I think that's right. It's going to be very difficult to get that guy to give up his gun. But I think the real energy and heart and soul of the modern gun rights movement is among urban gun owners who want guns for their own personal protection and their allies in rural communities who agree that that's the basic purpose for having a firearm. I think this is where, in the 1970s, the Democratic Party started, or in the 1980s, the Democratic Party started to try to appeal to the gun rights world by saying, you know, we'll never stop people from hunting or recreational shooting. And it's a misfire, if you don't mind me using the term, because that's not what the gun rights advocates are really concerned about. They think if you take the Second Amendment and make it about a hobby or recreation, then it won't last for very long.
We should open it up for questions. And I know there's microphones, and they'll bring you the microphone. And again, if possible, if you could keep the question, keep relatively brief, because there's many people who'd like to ask questions.
Hello. So I was thinking about what you said earlier about a social movement to change the idea around the two extremes. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and then you mentioned that 50% of the people who use guns are suicides. And then here in Los Angeles, the majority of people who die from gun violence are men of color. So my theory is, if a social movement were to occur where mainstream people were the people who were dying, would that sort of flip this idea where people would start saying, we need gun control because, you know, it isn't just people who kill themselves and people who are considered not as valuable are now being killed. And it sounds to me like that's kind of what happened in D.C. Mm. Because, it's a majority black, or it used to be, I think it's changing, but and they're valued there.
Yeah, that's it's a great perspective and a great point. And one of the things I do address in the book quite a bit is what is the relationship between minority oppression and guns? You know, the truth is part of the story of guns in America is that whites have always used gun control laws to keep blacks and other racial minorities as second-class citizens. The founding fathers had gun control laws that specifically banned slaves and free blacks from owning firearms. The KKK began, in some sense, as a gun control organization. The KKK began right after the Civil War. One of the things that had happened in the Civil War we don't think about too much is that for the very first time in American history, Southern blacks got their hands on guns. Either because in the South before the war, they were always banned from having guns. And Southern blacks, some of them joined the Union Army. The Union Army allowed them to keep their guns when the war was over because they couldn't pay their past wages that were due. So they said, keep your gun. We'll deduct it from what we owe you. Other African Americans, especially those who lived in the South, said, you know what, I'm buying a gun to protect myself now that I can. The marketplace was flooded with the hundreds of thousands of firearms that were produced for the war. So as the war ended, blacks were armed for the first time, and Southern whites, who were the Southern white racists, were not going to stand by and see this. And so they used gun control, either through legislation like the Black Codes that specifically said African Americans could not own a firearm, to more informal means like posses that would go out at night in large groups to invade black communities, go in there into homes and take away those guns. That was another mechanism by which racist whites kept blacks in second-class citizenship. And I think that part of the gun laws of the 1960s, I think race was very much part of the discussion, or less of the discussion and more of the thinking behind some of the gun control laws of the 1960s. So I think there's a very complicated relationship. You're absolutely right that when people who are going to use guns are not valued, those guns will be easily taken away. And similarly, if the people who are losing their lives are not valued by the larger community, then maybe they'll allow them to keep killing themselves, which is, you know, it's part of the unfortunate reality of racism and hierarchy in America.
The microphone.
You did a superb job of covering this subject. We have, as you said in passing very quickly, we have 20,000 laws addressing firearms at various levels, federal, state, and then regulations that are even county and even municipal. We don't lack for attention to trying to direct what is proper and improper use and behavior with firearms. I saw in 1970 a book by John Lott. It was entitled More Guns, Less Crime. I bet you know the book. Now, what I admired about the book, and you may tell me there's been something much better since.
Can I ask you to ask a question?
Well, my question is, what is the relationship between what we're trying to do with laws and the facts of whether or not the laws change anything in a favorable direction? That's what that book was about. Mm-hmm. And he had the statistics better than I'd ever seen elsewhere. It didn't show.
So this has become perhaps the most important piece of literature in the gun rights movement is this book by John Lott and the argument that the book made. It's called More Guns, Less Crime. And the idea was that it was a book of real empirical social science, a lot of number crunching, regression analysis, charts and graphs, the kind of stuff that you'd never want to sit down and read. And one of the things I can happily say most about Gunfight is that it is not that kind of book. This is a book about storytelling that's designed to be engaging. But John Lott's argument was that if you studied places that liberalized, made it easier for people to carry a concealed weapon, crime rates dropped. And there was a correlation between more guns out on the street, more gun permits, and less crime. Now, there's been subject to a lot of withering attacks, that research, and I think the only thing you can really take out of the research, really, at the end of the day, is that where states liberalized gun laws, it didn't lead to huge spikes in violence. It may have led to a small decrease. Other studies came in and said, you know what, we can take one state out and it changes the whole table, but it doesn't lead to great increases in crime or great reductions in crime. It doesn't make a big difference, in part because, remember, the guns are already out there. And in general, when it comes to something like permitting, the people who are going to be permitted are going to be the ones who are least likely to commit criminal acts.
But Adam, if I can just follow up, is there any reason to believe that any kind of law could make a difference in light of what you've just said?
Well, I think that any kind of law is going to be difficult. But look, the Brady background check law has prevented the sale. It was passed in 1994, and it set up an instantaneous background check. So, like I said, this is the 60% of guns that are sold through lawful mechanisms, but that go through a licensed dealer. And they have this background check. And it's stopped over 1 million people who've tried to purchase firearms from federally licensed dealers. Now, if we want to know how effective that law is, that seems effective right there. It stopped them from buying a gun that day when they were trying to do it. Obviously, some of those criminals, if they were really determined, went somewhere else and found a gun somewhere else on the streets in an illegal deal. So it's never going to be perfectly effective. But all you can do is say, hey, you have to require this background check. If you don't, you've committed a criminal offense. And if we catch you, we're going to put you in jail and create disincentives for people. But again, we shouldn't hold up gun laws to a standard that it's got to have a serious reduction in gun crime more than we do the fact that we have murder laws that don't lead to great reductions in murders or rape laws that don't work that well. I live in Westwood. Luckily, it's a low-crime neighborhood. But the laws that prevent people from breaking into parked cars and stealing their iPods, it really has not been very effective there either. We shouldn't get rid of the law, though.
Thank you. When you mentioned the turning point in the 70s when a new group took over in the NRA and really was emphasizing this basic fear that the government was going to take all guns away and take away the right to bear arms. That brought to my mind some of the more recent debates about the healthcare laws. It seems as though there are periods of time in history when a certain issue is picked out by maybe other forces instrumentally to raise that level of fear. My question for you is, to what extent will we need to look at additional strategies, and what other strategies might we need to look at to address the outside forces that are trying to fan the flames?
I don't think there's any law that we should ever adopt that tries to stop outside forces from joining a coalition of other people who believe the same thing and fighting for what they believe in. As long as they're doing it for peaceful means through democratic processes, and The gun rights movement does that. I do talk a little bit about the real extreme in the gun rights movement, the militia guys out there. I talk about, you know, Timothy McVeigh was motivated to bomb the Mura federal building in Oklahoma City by a very extreme vision of gun control. He was a big opponent of ATF and a big supporter of the Second Amendment and a big gun rights advocate. Those are the forces that we should stop. And it's not because they're joining forces, it's because they're doing something illegal. But I don't think we should be trying to stop people from fanning the flames in a democracy. That's called public discussion. I'm not one for Fox News or for television news much at all. But I guess there's a lot of flame fanners, I guess you'd call them. I don't know. And that's freedom of speech. So.
I really enjoyed your discussion this evening. I teach community college in Pasadena, and you can imagine the debates the students have amongst each other over these issues. I need to prepare a lecture, and I need your help here.
How will I
address the issue of incorporation in terms of Heller? Can we now say that the Bill of Rights has been nationalized in the area of the Second Amendment?
So the question is about a legal doctrine called incorporation, which has nothing to do with corporations. That's how the law works, yeah? That's how we keep it to ourselves, you know? And the basic idea is the Second Amendment, like most of the Bill of Rights, only applies to the federal government by its terms. So the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law. It doesn't say anything about the city council in Boston. It doesn't say anything about the state of Georgia. It says Congress. And so the Bill of Rights originally only applies to Congress. And then after the Civil War, with the adoption of the 14th Amendment, the court in time read the 14th Amendment to apply those provisions in the Bill of the Rights to state and local governments and to say, you know, no, the state of Georgia, the Boston City Council, they have to respect the basic Bill of Rights protections. Clearly, the Supreme Court held in 2010 that the Second Amendment was incorporated to apply against the states through the 14th Amendment. One of the interesting things about that case is it really gets into the story of the KKK. You know, I talked about the KKK and forming as a gun control organization and the efforts that Southern whites went to try to keep African Americans from having guns in the South. Well, that overly aggressive gun control, often in American history, leads to a huge backlash. And the backlash in those days was a very good one, which was the establishment of passage of the nation's first Civil Rights Act, the Freedmen Bureau Act, and finally the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which were all designed to protect, provide federal legal protection for the right of the freedmen to exercise their basic Bill of Rights protections, their rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and including, frankly, and they talked about it over and over again, the right to keep and bear arms for personal protection. So I think the 14th Amendment, the Second Amendment, is incorporated, certainly, to apply to the states now. Doctrinally, that's an easy question. But the story behind it, actually, is one of those really fascinating stories about how guns and our efforts to balance gun rights with gun control have shaped this country in really fundamental and important ways.
How helpful has the media been on both sides? We have these two extremes where I don't think each side trusts each other. The pro-gun people think that our fear that all of the guns are going to be taken away, and the anti-gun people think that when the assault weapons ban expired that the murder rate was going to triple. Neither one of those things have happened. So how can the media, or who in the media, can enlighten both sides so the extreme can come more to the middle ground from both sides? Thank you.
Adam Winkler in his book, Gunfight.
I don't know exactly what that answer will be. And you're right. I mean, part of the problem is the flame fanners that we've talked about. So I was thinking a couple months ago, I was thinking, well, what could I do to help promote this book? And someone said, well, you know what you should do? You should do become more of a talking head on these television news programs. You know, you get your name out there, and when the book comes out, I'm like, yeah, that sounds interesting. So I talked to a television booking agent. And I explained to him what I did and what my perspectives were, and he said, "Okay, so wait, I'm not getting it. Are you far on the left or far on the right?" I said, no. My whole deal is like coming at this like based on research and expertise, and I tell the story as it is. And sometimes that falls in the left, sometimes it falls in the right, sometimes it falls in the middle. And he said to me, "Do you watch television news?" No. Okay.
What role, if any, do you think gender plays in these issues?
Gender is a great issue, with regards to guns, there's no doubt that the story of guns in America has been heavily gendered. Obviously, guns are much more associated with men than they are with women, per se. But that's, you know, the truth is the one throughout American history, there have been efforts to promote gun ownership among women and others who might be most easily victimized. One of the reasons why people want guns for self-protection is because they feel they're going to be overmatched or outpowered by someone else. So if I don't have a firearm and someone tries to hurt me, I'm not big enough to fight back. And obviously for women, in a world where men are rapists far too often, sexual assailants, this is something that that they have, well, I think, some good reason to be concerned with. So there's always been an effort to try to promote the idea that women should have more guns than they do. But obviously that's never really taken on. And it's funny, I always do in my class, I teach a seminar on gun rights and gun policy. And I ask at the beginning of the class, how many of you have ever thought of having a gun for self-defense? And it's by and large mostly the men. And then I say, how many of you have thought about having a taser for self-defense or mace? And it's like, and almost every woman in the class has carried in college a self-defense tool, like mace, or now these days there's increasing love in some states of tasers. But, and the funny thing is that none of the men, they thought about carrying guns, but none of them ever carried guns. The women said, "We don't need anything for self-defense, but we carry a self-defense weapon." So it's again the story. It's always more complicated, I think, as you dig into the surface. And one of the things I hope you'll find with Gunfight is that when you dig under the surface, you'll be very surprised by the strange bedfellows and interesting twists and ironies in the story of guns in America. It's really not what you expect.
Last question.
There seem to be many debates in this country where the left and the right have been able to come together and find common ground, freedom of speech issues, establishment issues. What makes the gun issue so divisive? I mean, it's gone to this point where there really is no reasonable common ground, and it's really just, you know, guns on the left or guns on the right or no guns on the left.
Well, I do think that part of the main sticking point in the gun debate from moving towards a more moderate middle has been this question of disarmament, about getting rid of all the guns. I think that there have been those who, the left more recently is in recent days much more pragmatic and realistic that they're not going to get rid of the guns. But in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a real push to eliminate civilian gun ownership or to make us much more like England, where, you know, if you have a shotgun or a rifle, you keep it in a gun range rather than in your own home. And I think that's really, there are people who, on the other side, who really fear that they're going to have their guns taken away. And that's why I do think that this Heller case, by taking that disarmament off the table, in the long run can really help be the foundation upon which we do move beyond the polar extremes. Because that, I think that most important issue, it's not the only one, Erwin's pointed out some others, can help us move beyond if we have that one thing sorted out.
Gunfight by Adam Winkler is a terrific book. Please join me in thanking Adam for being here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.